We have on our docket this afternoon for oral argument, three cases. The first case we have scheduled is case number 08-CA-2268, Larson versus Lacy. Council set up and ready for that case. Okay. And then we have, secondly, Wiedemann versus Krebs-Wiedemann. That's not correct, is it? Yes, Wiedemann versus Krebs-Wiedemann, 08-CA-1288. Council in the courtroom for that case?
Yes, Your Honor. James Brown for the prosecution.
Thank you. Thank you. And then we'll have a third case, which is Starr versus ICAO. Council happened to be here for that. They're probably not here yet for that one. Council on the Larson versus Lacy case, have you had the opportunity to read the court's policies regarding oral argument? And do you have any questions about any of that? Okay.
My last appeal, I was able to use a picture, and I can point to it for this much. But I want to ask the court question.
Sure. And close enough where we can see it.
Yeah, I don't know. These real estate cases are difficult.
And before we get started, I'll just advise everyone in the audience, please make sure that your telephones are turned off or pagers or anything else that you have that might beep so it won't interrupt the arguments. And counsel, under our new timing system, it's self-monitoring on the time you wish to reserve for rebuttal. But if you want to shoot for a particular time for rebuttal, let me know and I'll try to help you. If you
can read the instructions, 5 minutes is when the yellow light will go off.
Right. I'll try to remind you if we go by that. So the court calls case number 08-CA-2268, Larson versus Lacy.
Thank you, Your Honors. Ronald Young on behalf of the Lacys in this case, who are the defendants and appellants. This case concerns briefly, I'm going to go over to this demonstrative because a picture tells a thousand words, and I'll just kind of lay it out for you briefly. I'll try to speak up since I understand we're being recorded.
This property, or this case concerns property that's all located in the northwest quarter section of section 19.
Excuse me, just a
counsel.
Minute. I'm not going to get a recording.
Yeah, why don't we
have to bring it
why
up.
Don't you bring the easel up closer to the podium?
Okay.
And I think it might be easier for us to see also from there. That'll work.
All right, thank you.
Can you everybody see it? Can you see
Perfect.
It?
All right, this case concerns real estate that's entirely within the northwest quarter section of section 19. The plaintiff, Michael Larson, and his wife, the Larsons, own this 80-acre strip. Prior to my client's acquisition of this corner, John Larson, the plaintiff's nephew, owned this 80-acre strip. This case concerns a road and two alleged easements. The west easement is alleged to be right here. There's an east easement, which is alleged to be right here. And what happens is you can travel from this county road on John Larson's property to this corner. And then there's a road that is primarily on Michael Larson's property. It goes up all this way till about this corner of the property here. And then there's an easement that goes this way. The road continues north. And it actually goes straight all along Michael Larson's property now. And there's also an alleged easement that kind of curves off and goes on to the Lacy property now. Michael Larson, the plaintiffs reside in this area right here.
And is the Lacy property right there in the corner?
Is this rectangular shape that was subdivided from this parcel immediately prior to the sale in 2006.
So the Lacys have 3.5 acres up there?
Correct.
And now, before this happened, the brothers, Mr. and Mrs. Larson family, they have two lots, basically, the defendant's 80 acres and his brother, the other.
This is a nephew.
Right.
And an uncle.
Okay, now, when did they start going across the property that now belongs to the Lacys?
The evidence shows that this goes back to the 1930s. It predates either owner.
Okay.
There was a witness, and I emphasized this witness in the briefs, who had lived there. He was the predecessor owner of this park. He testified that both parties used all of these roads with permission since the 1930s, which was when he was familiar with the property.
And who owned it then?
This was owned by Ehrlich, Mr. Ehrlich.
Mm-hmm. Did he own all of the property that now belongs to the Larson brothers?
No, Mr. Ehrlich only owned this part. And the history that I know goes back as far as the Wells, which owned back in the, I believe, you're testing my memory, back towards the 50s, the Wells owned this part.
Now, why did they need to go through the Lacys property at this point?
Back in the 30s, I'm speculating here, but this was all farmland, Your Honor, and so these roads were used for the convenience of accessing the farms and then removing the farm product, whatever it would be. Back when this road and the other, both the easements were being used, I really don't know why they chose to go out that way. There's some testimony that there's this right angle that is hard for trucks to pull in right here. There's also a culvert that was created by the owner of the east track, which runs along here, and there, so they had to build kind of a bridge over that. And so apparently it was difficult to get the long trucks to turn there. That's what's been alleged. I don't know, because it was all way before my clients acquired the property and before even the predecessor owned it.
Now, you were also, in your brief, you talked about the dueling presumptions.
Correct.
Historically, Colorado's had two presumptions, and you were asking us to use the one that presumes it's permissive. Could you explain that again?
Sure.
I remember this came up in Proper versus Grager and a few other cases. If a road is built that goes through an area that belongs to just one owner, then it's presumed to be permissive? Is that the way it works? Well, refresh me, please.
I'll move back to the microphone, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It's a little bit more complicated than that. In essence, Colorado started out with this presumption that if there was a use that was sufficient to place the owner on notice that someone was using their property that was hostile to their ownership, and they did it for the 18-year period, then there was a presumption of adverse use.
Okay.
Then the courts, and I think it came out in the Vade case and Lively, and somewhat in the Allen case, and those are all cited in the briefs, they came out with an exception, two exceptions basically. The Allen exception is that if the owner uses the same path for his convenience and purposes, then there is a strong presumption that it's permissive use for the other party using it. And then the Vade case, the Vade and Lively case, goes further to say that you really have to establish, in order to create this presumption of permissive use, you really have to establish sufficient control and dominion in order to place the owner. It doesn't have to be antagonistic, but it has to be a sufficient control to place the owner on notice that, hey, these people are going to claim adversely. I hope that answers your question, though.
Follow-up question. Now, explain to us why you feel the permissive use is the correct presumption in this case, because you're saying the judge erred as a matter of law by not applying the permissive use. Instead, he said there are 18 years, it's adverse.
Correct.
Tell us why he was wrong, please.
Sure. To the credit of the trial court, they were not presented with the other presumption, the presumption of permissive use, and there was no argument made at the trial court level regarding the other presumption. But regardless of that, the trial court was in error, because the only evidence that was before the court was evidence that was testimony by Mr. Ehrlich, who testified that absolutely, that's a quote, the use by both of these tract owners of each other's roads was permissive.
Well, counsel, let me interrupt you on that. I'm looking at the quotation on page 27 of your opening brief. Is that the testimony you're referencing, or is there other testimony in the record that you have not told us about?
That's the testimony I'm referencing, Your Honor.
Okay, please show me where in that testimony it says absolutely the use was permissive.
Okay. Page 115 of the record, Your Honor. I'll just read from line one, the witness. And I don't have my brief in front of me, but I do have the transcript of the trial. As I got older and understood how right-of-way worked, the mutual beneficiality of a right-of-way, I said, well, that makes sense. Everybody gets a little good out of doing something like this. Question, okay, when did you develop this understanding about a right-of-way? Answer, good heavens, 10, 12, somewhere in there, maybe. Question, okay, now you indicated that you never had to ask permission to use this road. Is that correct? Answer, nor did anybody else ask to use the road through the field. Yes. Okay, question, okay, was that because it was understood that both sides were granting permission? 15, correct. And, question, to the other to use that road? 17, line, or I'm sorry, answer at line 17, absolutely.
Okay, well, that's not quite what you just said, counsel. It doesn't say it was absolutely based on permission. Tell us how the testimony you just read us establishes that the use was permissive.
Well, his understanding that he's answering the question, was it your understanding that both sides were granting permission? He says, correct.
That's it. That's all the testimony you got.
That's the only testimony about permission in the entire case. Every
how
other
does that mean you get a presumption of permissive use?
Well, because there's no contradictory testimony. But the other reason that you get the presumption of permissive use is because of the case law. in essence,
well, like, first you have to have testimony that indicates it's permissive before you can get a presumption, right?
Right, which we do, which I maintain we just talked about. Correct.
Okay.
Every other witness testified in the case that they never asked for permission, it was never denied, and it was never granted. So there's nothing that contradicts the only witness that goes back to 1930 who said that both sides, both farmers, were using each other's roads with permission. And so,
well, this testimony doesn't say I asked for permission and got permission. It's just you understood it was permissive, right?
Correct. Which I would submit, I think, is the same thing. I see that my yellow light's on. I'd like to reserve some time.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Mr. Young, I'm Brandon Houchins, registration 31991. I represent Michael and Michelle Larson, plaintiffs' appellees. I will start by addressing the line of questioning regarding evidence of permission. Mr. Young did not point out, nor did any of you ask, about the other evidence in the case. And notably, even if you are confused by these perhaps dueling presumptions, and I don't think they are dueling anymore, I think the case history leads us to a place where the presumption is, after 18 years of continuous use, there is a presumption of adverse use, thereby shifting the burden to the owner of the property to show permission. But if we look at the evidence at trial, the Lacys did not present any witness of their own, not a single witness, who testified about at any time there being permission requested or granted. And I certainly agree with the way the trial court construed Clarence Ehrlich's testimony. Clarence Ehrlich was asked by myself and the Lacey's trial counsel about this issue of permission. And although Mr. Ehrlich answered in the affirmative to one of Mr. Osofsky's questions, I had the opportunity to redirect him. And at page 107 of the transcript, you'll see that I asked him So did anyone ever grant you permission to use that? I mean, did anyone say, oh, Mr. Ehrlich, if you, and then he interrupted me, and he responded by never had to ask. I said, okay. Then he said, and nobody ever asked if they could drive on that road through the field either. And Mr. Ehrlich's testimony dated back more than 50 years because, as Mr. Young indicated, he and his family had owned the Mike Larson East 80 acres for that period of time. As Mr. Young pointed out, the West 80 acres, prior to it being in the Leland John Larson side of the family, had been owned by the Wells family. Well, we had Steve Wells, a member of that family, and someone whose familiarity with the land was established through his testimony. He also testified, and he was asked about both of the easements claimed here. And he also said that nobody ever asked for or was granted permission to use these claimed easements. And that testimony from both Mr. Ehrlich and Mr. Wells is instructive for this court, particularly if you look at the Auslander v. McMillan case, which was cited for a couple different propositions in the briefs, most notably that the continuous 18 years of use by the claimant of the prescriptive easement results in the presumption of adverse use. The Auslander court also mentioned that acquiescence can lead to the prescriptive easement, and that was cited by the court in its findings and conclusions. What's important from Auslander, and this is a quote from the case, is the evidence is uncontradicted that no permission was ever sought or obtained for this use. Well, that parallels nicely with the testimony from both Mr. Ehrlich and Mr. Wells, who testified, notwithstanding the semantical wrestling he did with Mr. Osofsky, that nobody ever asked for permission and nobody was ever granted permission. That's right on point with the Auslander case. So the only evidence at trial on the issue of permission actually came from our side, which indicated that there had never been permission either granted or requested. Not a single Lacey witness testified to the contrary. So the only evidence that the Lacys can present to this court is this little dialogue between Mr. Ehrlich and Mr. Osofsky at trial, which I think the trial court appropriately concluded meant anything but actual asking for or granting explicit permission. So I think that's the strongest argument in favor of affirming what the trial court did. The trial court made a finding of fact. It's well supported in the record, and it shouldn't be disturbed on appeal by this court. If you look kind of at the minutiae of the case history on this issue of permission, particularly dating back to Horn, where it appears there may have been some other way to look at this issue of permission, you'll see some distinguishing facts that permeate throughout the history, and I think that the court doesn't need to struggle with this idea of creating a new presumption or necessarily even announcing some clarification. All the way from Horn through Brown, the most recent case, there is this presumption that arises. Now, in Horn, the language in the case is a bit different, and you may even view it as being opposite the more recent cases. But the fact in Horn that I think was probably dispositive either under that standard or a new standard is that the plaintiff, the person claiming the easement in that case, testified that she would not have dumped dirt on this alleged easement if she had been asked not to. Well, that's an admission by the party that she didn't view herself as claiming this easement under a claim of right or adverse to the owner of the land on which it lied. So her own testimony undermined her there, and I think it would have under the more recent presumptions and the cases applying those presumptions. But then 25 years later came True Blood, and the language in that opinion is more helpful in establishing the presumption of adverse use once it's been demonstrated that the use has been open and continuous for 18 years. And I think it's important for the court to recognize here that that's not being challenged by the Lacys. The Lacys are not challenging that the Larsons, plaintiffs Larsons, had, and their predecessors, back to Mr. Ehrlich's days, had openly, continuously used these two claimed easements on this property for more than 18 years. So that's not disputed. The only dispute is this issue of permission. And in True Blood, we get the presumption that follows throughout the case law. And then, interestingly, in Allen v. First National Bank case, Again, what we have there is the trial court finding some fact that the Court of Appeals didn't overturn, recognizing the presumption, but what the Court of Appeals and Allen recognized from the trial court is that the plaintiff claiming the easement subordinated his use to the use of the defendant and his tenants. It was a driveway, and the evidence in the case was if there was a time when both sides wanted to use this claimed easement, the plaintiff would defer to the defendant. And that fact was central in the Allen decision. And that was just a couple years later in 1950. Then
I'd like to just ask one question, if I might, since time is relatively short. The inquiry notice issue, if the court was correct in saying you have an adverse easement, how does inquiry notice come into this case?
The Lacys argued at trial that the easement wouldn't survive the conveyance from John Larson to Amber and Kyle Lacy if the Lacys weren't on notice of the existence of the easement. And we concede that the existence of that easement wasn't of record. So a trip to the clerk and recorder's office or an examination of the title work wouldn't have revealed the existence of the easement.
So do you concede if they did not have inquiry notice that the easement would not have survived?
I don't know that I'm prepared to concede that, Your Honor. I prefer to rely on the evidence at trial and the arguments that were made there and the findings of the court at trial.
The findings on inquiry notice are pretty slim. What do we have to uphold? I mean, the buyers bought the property from the sellers, 3.5 acres. It was specifically agreed they could fence those acres for their animals. Why would they think that tractors and other rigs would be coming through?
If the court is to look at the record, and I might make reference to this map that Mr. Young has presented, but if the court is to look at the record, the testimony of the parties is more helpful probably than this photograph, in that the east easement, that which begins on the Lacy property.
Would you point it out?
Certainly. I think what we're talking about is this area. Yes, so this is the claimant's property, this is the defendant's property. And here's the Lacy home, here's their 3.5 acres. This east easement from the county road, formerly Highway 392, begins such that it lies entirely on the Lacy property. As it travels southward, it moves to the east and then lies entirely on the plaintiff's property. And it continues all the way down this 80 acres and takes a right turn here, or a left turn for us, and goes out to this county road, 61, or maybe 68, not that important. So it's apparent that this goes all the way around here out to this road. But just visually, and this was presented through the testimony of several witnesses, if you look at it, you can tell that it starts on Lacy's property and not that far south, transitions such that it's entirely on Larson's property. And there's nothing that stops it. So it would have been apparent to somebody looking at it that, hey, this road wouldn't just serve my property. That wouldn't make any sense. It's gotta be used by somebody to get to the property to our east. So that's as to that easement. As to the easement on the west, is a wider easement. This is the one used for farm machinery. And Mr. Ehrlich, Mr. Wells testified about its historic use, but they also testified as to its appearance, as did the expert surveyor Ken Alice. Mr. Alice testified that when he went out to survey it, and this was shortly after the Lacys acquired their property, that it was apparent that it began from west of this building, and it traveled southerly until it got to this point, and then it didn't just die out, it continued on to the plaintiff's property. And so just from a visual perspective, you could tell that there was something happening there, and Kyle Lacy testified that he knew that this west easement probably served other property. And specifically, he negotiated with John Larson as to a restriction of that use or a continuation of John Larson's ability to use that land to access a water.
Was Michael Larson involved in those negotiations?
He was not. And what you can perhaps discern from the record in this case is the family Larson isn't one big happy family necessarily. And what you'll see also in the record is that Michael Larson went to his brother and his nephew and said, are you selling this property, or I'm maintaining my claim to these easements. That discussion happened shortly before the sale. But Michael Larson didn't have any communication with the Lacys until after they closed on that transaction.
Why are these easements across Lacy's property still required by Michael Larson when there's an alternate route to access their property?
And of what alternate route are you speaking, Your Honor?
Isn't it, well, weren't you just showing us a route coming from the south along the east side of, this is Michael Larson's property on the...
Michael Larson over here.
Right. And then there's a, I thought you said there's a road that starts down on the west side over here and runs to the east, then runs north.
It's a good question, Your Honor. It's an issue of angles primarily. When we're talking about big farm machinery, turns can't be made on a little bit of width at a right angle. So whether it's coming off this road, primarily it would be coming around this corner here, that would be an issue. And there's some ditch equipment here, a culvert, and ditch goes this way and that way. And the same is true actually on this corner for big farm machinery. So as always, for years and years, come across here where there's a much wider swath and a lesser severe angle to end up on the west portion of Mike and Michelle's farm here on that side.
And just, I want to make sure that the court isn't distracted by the notion of necessity. This isn't a case we brought under a theory of easement by necessity.
No, we appreciate that. But the deal was made between the Lacys and the brother. That's who they bought the property from?
Leland, that's correct.
Leland
and Michael are brothers.
Right.
John is Leland's son.
Oh, okay. But who sold the property was John.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Did the Lacys have any dealings with your client?
None at all. Not until after closing. And my client went to introduce himself, and he explained that he had a claim to these easements, and they rejected.
I get it. So he's ready to fence it and thought they could. Nothing showed that they couldn't, and then your client said, wait a minute, we weren't involved in this, and we have this easement.
I wouldn't necessarily agree with the notion that nothing said they couldn't. That hints at the issue of inquiry notice. And so I think, okay, as the trial court concluded, an inspection of this property by anyone, including the Lacys, would have at least suggested facts that would have put them on inquiry notice.
What facts again? You're saying the topography?
That's correct.
There's nothing in the paperwork. You can see nothing in the paperwork put them on notice.
That's correct.
And they also had the contract that said you can fence it.
That's correct.
So what does it boil down to put them on inquiry notice again? I'm troubled by that.
Okay, well, if you look at the record, the testimony of the witnesses, it's the layout of the property. It's that any reasonable person viewing the property would have known facts, for example, that the east easement begins entirely on the Lacy property, and soon thereafter, and this is one continuous road, transitions such that it's entirely on the neighboring property. So there could be no question, if you're just looking at it, that this road was used by owners of other property. With respect to the easement on the other side, on the west side, again, if you look at it, it's a wide path. It starts in a southerly direction, transitions to the east a little bit with the same width, and then it continues to flow easterly such that it moves right on to the 80 acres to the east, the plaintiff's property. And there were some other indications that the trial court cited in its conclusion and its orders. And I see that I'm out of time. Are there any other questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Young, if you require, we'll give you another minute in addition to the time you're showing, since we took a little extra time.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Mr. Houchens.
You can never get a lawyer to stop talking before his time is due. This case can be easily dispatched, as Your Honor noted, without the need to go in to scrutinize the difference in the presumptions based upon this inquiry notice issue. If you look at the record, which Mr. Houchens indicates supports inquiry notice, you'll find at page 10 of the brief, of the answer brief, he cites that the court decision had three bases to support this inquiry notice. Number one, that easement 3 begins entirely on the Lacey land, and as it continues in the southerly direction, lies solely on the plaintiff's land. This is probably easier to look at. This is the unadmitted Exhibit D, or a copy of it. This is what they're talking about here. And if the court notes, it starts over here. It doesn't really rest entirely on the plaintiff's property until it gets to the point where it's leaving the Lacey track. And the other thing that's important to note is that there is a wellhead right here that belongs to John, the seller of the property. The other two alleged easements don't go on to the plaintiff's property until they almost entirely leave the Lacey property. So that brings me to the next point in the brief, that the Lacey suspected easements 1 and 2 were used for the benefit of another property. That's absolutely correct. He thought they were used for the benefit of the seller of his property,
which is over here, John Larson's.
And in fact, the record supports that, even though the record is somewhat skewed in the briefs. It actually says, Mr. Lacey, when questioned, Mr. Lacey, you testified just a moment ago that you suspected or knew that the easements 1 and 2 described here on Exhibit D, that at least the bottom half of those two might have been used by John to access his farm. Yes. And you could tell that by the course of those easements, that by the course that they took, he said, answer, it was real hard to tell. They would connect the road to what was then John's farm. Answer, well, honestly, it was all just flat dirt, just packed it all the way across. But the thought crossed your mind, did that pathway had been used previously for land that was going to be somebody else's? Answer, yes, only by John. So it was clear that the seller, and it's provided for in the contract and in the deed, the seller is going to maintain an easement for the water supply that runs underneath the property. And in fact, the last point that's relied upon by the plaintiff is that the Lacey's negotiated with the seller for continued use of this water easement. It's an underground easement that runs across the property. So basically, and I do want to correct a statement in my answer brief, actually in my reply brief, where I indicate that it's a clear error what the court did with respect to this inquiry notice. I resubmit that it's actually a de novo review because the facts are really not disputed. There's nothing in the contract that discloses the easements. This is not of record. The contract actually provides for the fencing. These are all undisputed facts. The seller agreed that it was permissible to fence the boundary. The title policy did not reveal the easements. The road after the easements, the continuation road, is not visible from the Lacey track. Now, that was something that was admitted to by Michael Larson.
He said that if you were standing on this parcel, this part of the road down here was not visible from that track.
So again, there's a reasonable expectation that these two pathways were used to access the farm of the seller. They had nothing to do with the track to the east. The boundary survey did not depict an easement. The ILC did not depict an easement. The right to fence the boundary was actually in the warranty deed. There is, as the court has pointed out, alternative access to the east track, both the resident and the farm, residents and the farm. That's undisputed.
When when you asked Mr. Houchens about the access, he has access this way, There is a road now that does not go on to the Lacy property that is entirely on Plaintiff's Farm, that comes down and actually connects to the county road. That's an oil and gas road that was created in 2007, I believe. There's also access to the residence and the farm this way from these roads over here.
So there's really nothing to place the Lacys on inquiry notice in this instance. And as correctly pointed out, without that notice, the Lacys take without the burden of the easements.
Your regular time has expired. Mr. Young, could you go ahead and wrap up your presentation, please?
Sure. I mean, in summation, when I reread the briefs and preparing for the oral argument, I determined that this inquiry notice issue was actually probably the best issue. I should have put that first in the briefs. I got a little wrapped up into the confusing, in my opinion, issues on the presumptive use. I do believe that the Allen case, the Vade case, and the Lively case all qualify the Auslander case in terms of acquiescence. They still say that even with acquiescence, you have to show sufficient dominion and control in order to place the owner on notice. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.